Harper's Ferry Charter required that no money or half the money come from government, no more than half?
My understanding was half.
No more than half. Okay. Yes. And what happened, when did Katzenbach stop being chairman?
And Don Frazier. Maybe
Don Frazier succeeded him.
He succeeded him.
And who succeeded
under John Rigby?
Okay, and who succeeded them?
Don Frazier was succeeded by Chuck Whalen.
Chuck Whalen, and he was succeeded by.
Just recently.
I believe sent home because he became addicted to opium.
From where?
He worked up with Pop.
Butter. It should be right back.
Oh yes.
Is that a locks on it?
There's no locks on there.
The locks went away.
Is that? It's called imitation lock.
It's called
we're making it.
See if you can find the lock.
I mean, I'm tired, but not that far.
Well,
there was a guy named Wingert.
How do you spell it?
W-I-N-G-E-R-T. He worked up north with Pop and Blaine. Well, yeah. Wait, you want to know how you do this?
I always use a knife. No, but
it's easier. Let me show you something here.
I've got it. Yeah, but go ahead.
What easy?
Yeah, show me.
Physics, my dear boy.
Yes.
If you do this,
that
just forces it up.
Okay.
If you hit it here, it'll come right out.
Oh, okay.
Got that on tape. That's good.
Yeah.
Especially the here and here.
Yes, but you were saying there was a guy named Wingert.
A guy named Bill Wingert. He eventually worked for the Ag Department as an ag engineer. But he and another guy, the other guy I don't know, I can't remember his name, they were up at San Antonio and they found him smoking opium in one of the dens up in San Antonio. And he was glassy-eyed, had all the classic symptoms.
Here we go, I found the locks for you.
Oh, thank you.
That's for you.
Was he still in IBS at the time?
Yeah. And I believe they sent him home. Blaine would know this guy.
Oh, the name isn't that important. What, sorry?
Do you need some transfer salsa?
Yeah.
Okay.
The question is, why would that happen? Is that just on a percentage basis? Great.
He's the only one I knew of.
The only one.
Yeah, but did you try opium? See, I did. I knew a lot of people that did, because we were told by a Vietnamese friend to see people who were smoking it. Explained that it was mostly people who were sick or needed it for. It was their drug. It was their medicinal painkiller. And they said you needed to go 3 nights to become addicted. And that you could go once, you could taste it, you could see how it felt, and no problem.
Everybody's different.
Yeah.
Oh, some people can do it forever. Some people just take a smell of it.
When they're gone. Well, this guy took us and got a couple from the State Department. I kept thinking, it'd be real fun when I find out if he's reported to something real important, because I know.
Well, I was on a high for 12 years when I was in there. I didn't need anything else. I mean, I didn't really need anything else.
Oh, you weren't in Vin Chin that much. In Vin Chin, it was the third eye was the place. And because Ron was a folk singer, and we were around a lot of the traveling entertainment that came to town, my first experience, I threw it away. After that, I knew what it was. And then it was the water pipes with the cream de menthe and smoking, you know, fooling the smoke. And
Did you ever smoke a water pipe?
Yeah. But I could, like, one puff, because I didn't drink or smoke cigarettes. So I totally believe Bill Clinton when he said he didn't inhale because it burns your throat. If you don't smoke,
right,
you don't inhale it. You just taste it and, you know, be cool so everybody doesn't think you're crude or something. Listen to them, doesn't everybody get silly? And that's why I did it. You know, I didn't smoke cigarettes. Galen used to carry it around like tea.
What?
His bag, he called it his Fox AT or something. I remember he had it in the ACA. And I went, Galen, you're going
to... Well, the story of a kid who...
Well, what was it, though?
Grass. It was just grass.
What are they... What an attendant. Sonny died going to heaven. Because he was getting his pot down at the morning market in kilo blocks, packaging them up, and then mailing them home. And of course, it got to the APO post office. They caught him. His dad was terminated.
Well, here's another issue. What about sex?
Oh,
boy. IBSers must have had sex.
Oh, yeah.
And I know a lot. I know a lot about the sex now.
Every day.
I found out after
but
I came
like
home
to know, yeah,
about Lulu's and about all the places there.
Well, no, let's rather than talk about the places initially, you don't have to name any names. That's not the issue.
No.
What was your impression, just generally, or little salient examples? I can't imagine us using this, but it does fill.
Well, if you're writing a movie script.
No.
I think every IBS guy participated in a big way.
Everything okay?
Yeah. Yummy. I haven't had one of your waffles for a long time.
With local.
I know, yeah.
Tell
it. It's on the edge today.
And what made it so easy and loud was, and Thailand, for that matter, was there was no stigma associated with prostitution. Not like you.
Well, in Laos, there were a lot of married couples, though.
Yeah.
Do you think that made any difference?
Well, I don't know that the married guys did it.
Yes, they did.
I'm sure they went down and, you know, participated. But
you mean when they flew into Vincent to get some supplies? Do you think they might have strayed?
No, I know in Vietnam.
I'm sure.
All through the American community, the men were going out. The military was there without their wives. So they knew where the girls were.
Uh-huh.
And all over, the men brought home venereal diseases. Ask Don Luce, ask Chief of Party. He knows who was treated.
That'd be easy to...
Well, we know it's not who that's that important.
But
right.
No, I would say.
I think the same thing. It was too tempting. It was just.
The gal. I remember the first time I came to Bangkok. I declared that Bangkok was the most dangerous city in Southeast Asia. Everybody said, well, why is that? Every storefront had a canvas on it hanging down. And to keep it from blowing in the breeze, they had a piece of pipe about this big around.
Uh-huh.
You know, you get angered?
Right.
Now the Thai would walk underneath that piece of pipe. Every American would hit it right here. And the only reason you hit that is because you were looking at some good-looking gal on the other side of the street. So you could tell the guys that were looking and the guys that weren't from the round circle that was embedded in their fork.
Well, one
you know what? I used to be, we're talking about the men, but I used to feel sorry, you know, for the military wives.
Yeah.
Because you know, watched their husbands in action. Then I was evacuated to Hong Kong with wives. And then I saw the wives in action. And it was the same way. But mostly, they were, well, these were civilian wives, but they were going out while the officers came down. Because they preferred round eyes to. At that point, they had their fill. So they appreciated somebody they could talk to.
No, I am. To me, it was a non-issue. It was an accepted, call it requirement of life, by every Lao, every Thai, every Vietnamese. And that was just the opposite of the attitude here in the States at that time. That was before the revolution took place.
Well, I understand it, but that's what I'm interested in. You get, let's for example, especially in the early years, you have all these volunteers, many of them are married. And they come to...
And you're married without kids, and that's a suspected right there. If you don't have kids, then, you know, there's something wrong.
But even so... Well, you don't have kids, you're not busy. You know, and a lot of people were putting off kids. They didn't want to have kids when they were Laos.
We were supposedly, you know, we're not supposed to. And I did because of the Vietnam evacuation. So that ended my IBS career. Because we agreed to extend an IBS, and then Ron picked up that USAID contract because Andrea came home.
Well, no, I'm just socially, I'm just interested in how, well, the volunteers that are coming in like after 68, that's a whole different kettle of fish.
Oh, yeah.
Betty met Fred in Vietnam.
Sorry?
Betty met Fred in Vietnam.
Okay, that's right. Betty met Fred. Yes, but that was an extremely unusual thing because he was in the military.
But
Betty didn't mind that. Where all the other IBSs wanted to keep their distance.
Yeah.
And she was not ostracized, but people just couldn't understand. But Betty's attitude was very different from any IBS writer. About that.
Yeah. And you know who else did? Carol Falk.
Who?
Carol Falk. She was in Tuckett when I was there.
Who'd she marry?
Well, he was a major who had gone. Drew. Colonel Frank Drew. And what happened was she met psychic in a village that really blew her away because she described her childhood and how she lived in the roads, you know, things that this woman had never seen in her village, but she described it in Carol's life, and she told her she would have two romances that and the third that she would marry him, and she said, well, I know that's wrong because she'd been going with Frank and he'd gone and they weren't getting married. Little did she know, she came home and married him. And the first time I saw her in D.C., she said, how many kids did that woman say I was going to have? She said she had three by then. I said, well, I remember three. So
it's like 5 minutes left.
Carol, a girl named, I think it was Betty, Blaine Jensen and I were the first to take that circle tour. We went to Siem Reap to see Angkor Wat. And that was the weekend that Prince Norodom Sihanouk chose to bring the Joe and Lai to Angkor Wat. There was no hotel space. I spent the night in a barber shop's chair.
Yeah.
That's the only bed available in town. Blaine and I slept in the barber's chair. And the girl slept upstairs at the barber shop. Now, to carry the thing on sex one step further, I think all the IVF girls were in demand by other Americans.
And too loud.
Yes, and what became very confusing, especially, I wrote somewhere about one gal committed suicide. One American gal committed suicide. Wasn't IBSer. I don't think it was IBSer. The USAID secretary was IBSer. Who, and the way I described this, she was a plain Jane in an area where any face would become a princess. And the man that she had fallen in love with everybody else had left without marrying her.
Well, what about, you mentioned that. Were there any, can you recall the names of the IBSers who married Lau?
Men, boys, guys?
Either way. Well, first of all, were there any IBS or females in-laws who married Lau?
Not to my knowledge. Well, Penny Gupta. Well, but she wasn't IBS.
She wasn't IBS.
Just IBS.
No, I don't know of any.
But see, that's also a factor that there weren't that many single women in Laos.
That's true. There were on the USAID side there were quite a few. Mm. On the IBS side, I don't know. There was a gal named Dawn Bowman. Single. A lot of the Ed team gals were single.
Fred Branfman married a Lao.
Vietnamese.
Well, Frank Beewitz married a Lao. Who is now Dave Duke. You know.
Right.
There were several. There were several guys who married Lao gals. And the temptation.
The red hair that came from Cambodia before we did.
Wynn McKeithen?
No, Wynn did, but the thing was that this guy stayed there because we saw him. I mean, he really went native, married and stayed. I remember seeing him in the village with bright red hair. And
it was very tempting. One of the gals I met was working as a secretary in Laos for the area coordinator. She was not only beautiful, charming, well-educated in France, just an awesome, awesome gal. And it was so tempting. It was just... to become a serious quarter. And you had to sit back and say, I'm not going to spend more than X years here. How is this going to work out at home?
And the answer is,
it wouldn't. And I'm not even including, I'm not even talking about the racial part of it. That never bothered me. But how would she adapt to a country like this?
Well, hundreds of thousands have.
Oh, I know, but I was looking at it, I was looking at it from, here's Laos. How is she going to handle a supermarket in L.A.?
Okay, well, how it happened with one guy who sensibly decided that he would send his fiancée to work in Washington at IBM so she would learn to know what she was getting into and to know American culture. This gal, who you'll know as soon as I say, came back and couldn't go live out in the countryside and laugh. She was an American. That was it. She was an Indian. Her name was Petzold. And she later had a child by an IVS that she pressed the paternity suit against. And one, I had met that child who had just been visiting her dad in Hawaii. She's on her way back to Ketong, and she is a lovely person. Yoder in Hawaii. A Yoder. He's at a university there. Peter Yoder? Y-O-D-E-R?
Peter Yoder?
I think so.
Because there's the only Yoder I know is Jim. He's not in Hawaii.
I have no idea.
So anyway, this is Somphone's sister. You met Somphone here. He was the IBS captain.
You know the little short gal who was...
And you want the whole story, asked Val. Because
Terry Collins.
No. Oh, Terry, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know where. Have you talked to Terry Collins? No. I don't even know where he is anymore.
He used to be with National Banking.
This gal, little short gal, cute little gal, came here. And, you know.
For years, I saw her all the time.
I haven't seen her.
Galen helped sponsor her. She told me one time that, and Galen talked to me before he sponsored her. He said, "You think I can do this without her thinking that I'm going to, you know, marry her?" And I said, "Well, you know your, you know, how you communicate with her and how your friendship is. I don't know, but I said, do you think it'd be a good idea to sponsor her and do it?" Because she worked with Americans all the time, and she spoke English.
Very sharp.
So, and you know, she cased out the offices in Century City and said this is where she should work. She got a job at Nestle's. All during the boycott, she was bringing me Nestle's products every time she came over. But she told me that in a past life, she was a princess that spurned a suitor. And she was getting paid back in this life. That was how she told me her feelings about Galen. And well, then she started dating Terry.
Yeah, and I don't know what happened. I don't know if they got married or I haven't seen
her. No, I think she's still here. And
I haven't talked to Terry.
Because Val has
Terry came over, God, it's been 15 years. I haven't seen him. I lost contact. I kind of shut down from everybody. Something like that. And anyway, I'm glad I didn't. And what I guess I was in the village that I lived in for the first year. There was a Lao girl there who was about 16 years old, who was probably the most beautiful creature I have ever seen in my life. I mean, she was just, and every guy who saw her just couldn't take his eyes off of this gal. She already had one kid and was working on the second, you know, while we were there.
Was working
on the second. The second one was in the basket while we were there, 16 years old.
Oh, the second.
And you keep saying, what? You know, how could this work? You know, how would this ever work in the States? I mean, you're talking about a village girl who's never plugged in anything, never started a car.
How did you know they'd all be here?
And it worked. I mean, they learned real quick, I gotta say that. But my wife is English, and we still have problems.
Yeah. Well, that's because the English are less adaptable than the
Oh, well, yeah. But I mean,
that's a proven fact.
And it just drives me crazy with some of the things she does. You know.
Well, was she married?
My wife?
No, the woman who had...
Oh, there's a loud... Yeah, she was married. But I'm thinking, you know, here I am looking at this gal trying to say, okay, how's this going to work there? And so I never allowed myself... to seriously consider a Lao girl or a Thai or a Vietnamese.
Now, but from what you know now,
Oh, I would have, this one gal that was that secretary, I would have asked her to marry me in a minute. Probably would have said no, but...
She was secretary for...
The area coordinator of Vincennes.
For USAID.
Yeah. What was it? Oh, God. In fact, my wife and I met at his brunch. Oh, what was her name? I'll think of it.
Yeah, no, it doesn't matter.
She was just an incredible beauty.
Well, people who did marry, there's some that didn't work out here.
Oh, I'm sure.
Came back, and the girls adjusted more than the Americans did, and got, you know, into the, you know, where I would say living in Laos changed our perspectives enough that it wasn't what happened. Like Metzong was that she became more American than Americans. She insisted on going to Bangkok to have a baby, like Americans did. And in fact, Americans were arguing that they should be able to stay at the Filipino hospital in Laos and not go to Bangkok.
Well, they didn't want to be away.
Yeah. But.
Well.
And I think that happened to Val twice. But you have to ask Val. Because he married another girl that was more of a rural girl. And when she came here, she changed.
Well, Frank Leewitz married a Lao girl who was a rural girl. And they have two kids. They're all grown up and gone now. Now, Harvey Nice married a Chinese girl.
And Lakeithan's wife, Maggie Thai. I think she's Thai. Because I met her in D.C.
I was surprised.
Well, I'm interested because I've met, who was it? Jim Yoder, who works for the Bank of America. It's in Walnut Creek, thereabouts.
That's not the...
No. Phil Schreiber, who lives in Oregon.
Schreiber sounds familiar.
Oh, yeah. Schreiber worked with Mike Chilton and Carl Groth.
Okay. Vietnam.
Yeah. And they're married to Vietnamese women. And
Mike Chilton.
Yeah. And what's interesting, Mike Chilton, right. And these women were all of very good families whose families were offended.
Yeah, I think a little more.
Whose families were a bit offended, you know, that they were dating Americans, because Americans only dated prostitutes. That was their...
Right, that was their impression. Yeah.
And,
Thank you. I'll eat some more water for you.
And, the struggle there was... But on the other hand, what was really interesting is two things. First, the women seemed to come from families who were not caught up in Saigon society. That is, they were traditional, well-to-do families. I think mostly Chinese, too.
Yeah.
But they weren't plugged into the regime.
Right.
And that was that I'll have to follow up a little bit, if there's any point to it. But the other thing is that they're really interesting women.
Yeah.
I mean, like Mike's wife, and they're strong.
Oh, Chris Jenkins' wife.
Oh, well, that's another, that's in another universe. Oh, yes, that's
so fantastic.
Yes, it's another universe.
What is she, Vietnamese?
Yeah, she is just fabulous.
Well, this is the thing that I looked at. The Vietnamese women who married Americans, and the Thai women who married them, and the Lao, tended to be very strong women. And... relating this to the more broad picture, when I was in my little village in Laos, I went to a village meeting. And forever the myth of the dominated woman was destroyed. Because in this village meeting, the women had more to say than the men. Not only had more to say, but were listened to. And not just pushed off to the side. But the impression you get was that this is a man's society and the man walks 20 foot ahead and rules. Well, it's not. It wasn't the truth. And then when I'd see these gals that married, because some of the men that I that married loved were kind of wimpy. I mean, I'm not saying this is negative. I'm just saying the women that they married were dominant. I mean, totally. And the guy just said, yes, dear, yes, dear, yes, dear.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing is the ones I've, the IBSers that I have met, have, they're women who are strong, but they're obviously in a relationship of equals. And the thing is, you know, I think it's all, there's no, I don't think there's any rule here. I think Fred probably married someone who was his equal. And Fred is extremely intellectual.
He wouldn't accept her as his equal.
He wouldn't?
But they're divorced. I know her very well.
Uh-huh. Well, tell me about her.
Well, she was Fred's support, took care of everything. I mean, she, right now, she runs a program, two programs in Oakland. One is a Saturday school for Vietnamese kids learn Vietnamese. I went to her school and went to the kindergarten class to refresh my Vietnamese with all these kids. And all the kids were not kindergarten age. They were older ages, but with families who had been here, and the kids hadn't learned Vietnamese. So they were sending them to the school
to learn
to read and write Vietnamese. They could understand it, that we were doing the ABCs and everything. And she runs this whole program there. She worked with Chris Jenkins, and then now she has her own program doing anti-gang, funded for...
What's her name?
Twa.
How do you spell it?
T-W-T-H-O-A. IBSers were involved in there after IBS Live. But, yeah, it just...
Where did Fred meet Twa? In San Francisco?
I don't know.
Because I don't think
I
asked
think in
him.
Washington. San Francisco.
Oh, Washington.
She was here. She came with the children, the victims of the war. The program was bringing children here that were picked up that had medical problems. She came here with them. She's terrific woman, survivor, independent, strong.
Well, my opinions of Fred have not changed.
Well, let me ask you something else of which I've learned a lot about lately.
And in many ways, she probably agreed with you. She's so funny, and she's so, she just doesn't pull any. And it's almost like she's had a double life because of her whole world there. And then now, here she is in San Francisco, looked up to by the whole Vietnamese community, including a lot of
she's
former colonels and generals. And,
very
you know,
bright,
yeah.
Intelligent.
And what she's doing now in her community is, you know, totally... positive. I told you the thing that Galen had said about Fred, or vice versa, about the, are you still lighting candles? Because Galen had accused him of just cursing the darkness and not doing anything about it.
Well, I think a lot of it would have to do with how bright, you know, these gals, and that, you know, hell. With everything so different. Jumping from one culture to another, and it's not just culture, you know, how we relate to each other and how we do things. It's the technology on top of all of that that really can throw you in a tiz. So, if you selected a gal who was sharp, no doubt they'll adapt and become a power in the new environment. But how many people can do that? I mean, how often does that happen? Do we pick women because they're bright? No. You know, men suffer this fatality.
No.
Look, at 16 years, from the age of 13 to the age of 18, men suffer a 3-foot drop in IQ. And they never recover from this.
Well, what about got kids. Were there kids left in Laos like there were in Vietnam?
American kids?
American kids, Lao American kids. Because you know a country
not,
more.
Not that I know.
Yeah, but it was just the numbers. I mean, there were almost 3 million Americans in Vietnam.
Right.
Yeah.
There weren't.
Because I've heard, though, that in the that there were kids in the camps in Thailand that were
I'm sure there were.
Sure there were.
Here was part of the problem. In Laos, children were treasured.
They'd be accepted more in Laos. Yeah.
Yeah. They were treasured.
Yeah.
Life expectancy in Laos was short. I mean, it wasn't unusual to have half your kids die.
Yeah.
Or higher.
Yeah.
So, and how would you know? IVSers that were there for 2 years and then they were gone. And how would that person get a hold of them? Or how would you as an IVSer even know that you had a kid there? You wouldn't. I'm sure that happened many times. I had a very interesting story when I was the area operations chief in public works. This gal and a guy came to the office looking for me. And my staff, chief of staff, my guy, says, Howard, didn't say Howard, he's the boss, there's a girl out there and a guy, and she says you owe her money. And I said, well, who is this gal? She says, well, she did your washing up in Luang Prabang. I said, she did my washing in Luang Prabang. Well, I worked in Luang Prabang for about 6 months, you know, in charge of all the project. And I was staying with another guy, a USAID guy, the ARMA guy. Anyway, and then I left because I was done with what I was doing. Well, it turns out he left at the same time and didn't pay her the money for cleaning the house and washing the clothes. But it was really cute because my chief of staff comes up to me and says, you didn't sleep with this gal. Is that what she's after? No.
Yeah, there's all kinds of stories of the guys that had the housekeepers that they'd clean up real good before she came.
That was really funny. Hey, what was this other question you've learned about?
No, I'm just throwing stuff out. You know, we started, you know, I said, you know, you're ruining this. But we were talking a little bit about Pop Buell.
Yeah.
And Pop's abilities or weaknesses. Strengths,
yeah.
Or weaknesses.
I've been thinking about that.
Uh-huh.
There was a guy, in my opinion, that was just trying to do good. And to him, doing good was giving the largesse of America to people who didn't or couldn't not afford it, but were in circumstances where their life was in a turmoil. He was in a position to help them. And I don't think he ever related the cost in humanity. Maybe he did. But he was supporting full bore the military aspect, the military part of the program. But not realizing that's what he was doing. That's my opinion. Maybe he did later on. Because he was feeding with USAID money, taking care of not refugees. These were not refugees bona fide, uprooted, torn, and taken in. These were the wives and families of military personnel.
Yeah, they were being supported so the men could go to college. Yeah, the rumor was that the kids grew up thinking rice came from the sky.
Yes.
Because they no longer cultivated their own rice.
They didn't have time. I mean, the men were out fighting. When you're fighting, you don't have time to plant rice.
So the Food for Peace program in Laos was...
A lot of it was the military. And here, See, and I never put it all together until way down south. I had just quit Public Works and was reassigned to the Refugee Relief and Rural Development. And I was flying into an area called Saravan that had just been recaptured by the FAR. And I'm flying in, I notice that all the seed patties are growing. You know, they plant seeds and then they transplant that into the patty. So I say, well, how can this be? If we're feeding 20,000 refugees in Pox A, who's planting the rice? You know, how can you have rice being planted when everybody's not supposed to be there? So when I got off the plane in Saravan, I had two of my guys with me. I said, I want you to do two things. I want you to ask everybody that we talk with who's planting rice and where are they? And I carried on negotiations with the colonel and da-da-da-da-da-da-da to get things going. When we got back to the office later on that day, I said, okay, what did you guys find out? He says, nobody left. What do you mean nobody left? Who are we feeding? You're feeding the residents, by and large, of the town of Saravan, who didn't own land. But none of the farmers left. I said, well, weren't they worried? I mean, no. Bad guys wanted them to plant the rice. I said, what are you
doing?
So I came back to Saravan with 10 guys. I went to every village within 20 kilometers of Saravan. No one had left. They were all planting rice all through this time. The bad guys, the Vietnamese, Viet Cong, assessed each family a tax of rice per, I can't remember if it was per hectare or per patty. It came out, after doing a little rough math, the bad guys were picking up enough rice to support two NVA divisions in South Vietnam from the Saravan area. Well, I wrote up a report and I handed it to the chief of the CIA in Pox A. He read this and about dropped his shoulder. Because they couldn't understand, because they were knocking off all the trucks coming down the road with the C-130 gunships and their night vision equipment, and they could put one bullet into an engine. That's how accurate they were. And they had these, they couldn't understand where all the rice was coming from. I said, it's coming from right there in Saravan. And we were feeding, thinking we were feeding the whole area to keep that rice out of the bad guy's hands. But it was just the refugees from the town and the landless that we were feeding. This document was top, one of those things, secret. And I don't even know for sure that document exists, because I've got a copy of it.
Well, it's curious that they could have targeted that area for spraying.
I said, well, here was the dilemma. The rice was being planted. And they asked me, what do we do? I said, you go to every villager and you give them kip and you burn it right now. Before they plant it. Before they have anything in it. Or you spray it and kill it. You pay them so they have to buy their rice from us. With the money that we're giving them. And then we'll give them just enough rice to get by. Not enough to give to the bad guys. They sat on it in Vincennes for 6 months.
No, I think we've been. We go on. Get some of these people out. Oh, they have empty tables.
There's plenty.
Yeah, they have empty tables.
6 months later, I get the call from the ambassador. He wants to have a meeting about this. So I fly up to Vincennes.
You can't come out here every time.
Well, how much is mine then? Bagel lot, okay.
potatoes too much.
Well, then that means I only have to give 5.
No, you know what? Why don't you... We should probably pay your extra tip.
I'm going to be able to get rid of some ones. Good. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. There's a tip. There's part of the tip. Okay. The rice
now. Do you
want
them change back?
No.
The rice is. When I got this message to come up to Vincent and talk about this, I thought that they were working on something. By the time they made up their mind they had to do something about it, the rice was already ready for harvesting. And guess what? The bad guys came in and took the territory back because they wanted the rice.
What year was that?
Oh, this was 70. 69, 70, 71. Now, the interesting thing was when you look at when were the offensives taken by the Potala? During the wet season? Never. At the end of the dry season to collect the rice. They let the FAR control areas until the rice was ready to harvest. And if you look at it, there's a pattern to this, from the south to the north. No one picked up on it. And me, the engineer, who isn't a specialist, who isn't looking for that kind of stuff. Well, yeah, I think you can have that chair. And no one believed it. In fact, when I came back from this survey with these guys, I wrote this thing up. I handed it to the area coordinator and the chief of station in Pox A. They didn't believe it. It went to Vincent. They didn't believe it. And then, remember the guy named Jack Williamson? And John McQueen? John McQueen was the director of Refugee Relief. Jack was his number one guy. He was right hands with Pop up in Sam Tong for a long time. And Jack and I became friends. But after this incident, I was no longer Jack's friend because I was supposed to tell Jack this information, not my local boss. Jack sent another survey team down to do what I had already done. And they confirmed it. So all these years, the rice was going to the bad guys. And that's why there were no trucks on the Ho Chi Minh train. I mean, for food. They would have had to increase tenfold their tonnage down the Ho Chi Minh Trail to supply their troops. But because they were getting the rice in Laos, they didn't have it. Now the Saravan area was the rice surplus area of Laos. That whole Saravan Valley and to the north, east, and south of the Plateau Bolivar, the Bolivar Plateau, was the rice basket of Laos. With one crop a year, it was a rice basket. Another area was east of Savannah Cap. And where was every year the bad guys retook that area?
Well, I'm very curious as to what June thought over the years of IBS leadership. Because I talked a lot to Richard Peters, and he talked about all these changes that happened within IBS. And I wonder whether you have any read on that. What do you think happened with, you know, the direction of IBS after...
I don't know. Walt Coward was the chief when I went. And Dayton Maxwell was his deputy chief. I like Walt. I think Walt was strong. Dayton was too easygoing. Real easygoing. And then after that, I don't know. But June does.
Well, I know from Dick Peters' time.
Uh-huh.
when Dick had appointed, and the board with Dick had appointed Nicholas Katzenbach, chairman of IBS, and he came here when Ron and I returned in 1970. We were involved with recruiting volunteers, went to some agriculture colleges around Central Northern California, and then also in after the Harper's Ferry meeting, they decided we wanted to not be totally dependent on government funding. And our own experience in Cambodia was that we could have stayed there and taught English for our 2 years had we been funded privately. Marty Klisch stayed with, I think, Rockefeller Foundation funds. He was the only IBSer that stayed, but the Cambodians wanted IBS to stay, and were kind of surprised to find out we were funded through the government so that we couldn't stay if they kicked out the government. So, and we felt that we would like to have stayed and been able to work in a neutral country. And many people didn't realize when they joined IBS as a private organization, with having been founded by the church groups that had service organizations, that it would be a totally government-funded entity. And like Miles used to say, it was the fingers on the hand of aid. But as Katzenbach was chair, he determined that there should be a board made up not only of you know, high-level professional people. Alan Basher was on the board then. I think he was the only former IBSer. And so Katzenbach said we need women. There were no women, and former IBSers on the board. Because we were involved in a Walks for Development in Beverly Hills, and they split their funds locally and internationally, and then we talked to that group about IBS. And because of David Gittleson being from here, Katzenbach came here, and we met with him, and he gave a recognition to Dave's parents at this meeting. We met at a little place in L.A., I guess some little restaurant. And then I was living on an apartment on Hermosa Avenue, and Chuck Cable and Billy Lee, and I didn't know if you were here then. This was early 71 maybe. And so I had met him, and then following that, I didn't know it, but Chuck Cable recommended that I be nominated to the board. Then I went to my first board meeting with Dick Peters and Alan Basher, and without Alan even asking me, they announced that I would be vice chair, but I was going to take Al's place. And I was like, wait a minute. And I was sort of intimidated, by the whole thing. And I thought, I guess I could do that, And I remember Les Brown of World Watch gave the speech, and he talked about how, as we're heading towards our bicentennial, that we're no longer independent. We're going to be dependent on other countries for so many of our resources and oil and everything. And my whole, opened up everything. My thing, I came home saying, anybody hear about an oil shortage coming up here? Who would believe that we would, be in that position from my perspective. Anyway, at that meeting, after I was made vice chair, and then I went to the executive committee meetings, and Katzenbach believed that we needed to make a change in director. So when he put together the search committee, he said I would...
Did Richard want to leave?
Huh?
Did Richard want to leave?
I don't know. I know that IBS was in dire financial straits, and the board was afraid he didn't have the connections and the fundraising capability to keep IBS going. I didn't know Dick Peters well at the time, and I was just like the new kid on the block. And because I was the only woman on the board, when they put together the search committee, Katzenbach just said, I want you to be on it. And, know, I said, okay. they in those days, they paid all the trips to D.C. So there were a lot of other changes going on in my life, and it was kind of neat for me to be able to stay involved. And I liked all the people and the opportunity to see friends when I went back. So,
well, there's still tables available, because I see people sitting on the sidewalk.
They're waiting for outside. Mm. Anyway, I became, and at the time that Katzenbach was here, we he found out that we knew Tony Lake and Holbrook from Vietnam. Tony was the assistant to Sam Thompson in Hue, and he and his wife were friends of ours. They worked a lot with the students in Hue. So I knew Tony well from Hue. But I didn't know. And Dick Holbrook. I didn't know well, but I knew we knew him because they were the only two Vietnamese-speaking State Department people that I knew of. And Tony was in Hue, worked with the students, and we were philosophically kind of, you know, not kind of. We really agreed with problems there with labeling the Buddhists. Communists. There was a big problem in the way at the time. Anyway.
And Richard Holbrook?
Well, Richard Holbrook was on the IBS board then. And he was chair of that committee.
The search committee.
And so I got to know him really well in the process of meeting with this committee. And found out that Tony was one of the applicants for director. Along with another guy from Laos I liked a lot. There were several people that I liked and knew well. Tony Babs.
Tony Babs is still doing community development work.
He has written a report from Laos, yeah.
Yeah, there's a company that, that's a better story.
Yeah.
So then what happened?
And so then in the process of the committee, I thought that Tony Lake would be great because of his experience in the countries that we've been involved in, and because of his education and also fundraising capabilities. So, but I didn't know how bad the financial situation was. It was after Tony was director then, Tony was selected, but after going through, and they always had an organization whenever there was a search, so it was a broad search, and then it got down to interviewing all of the candidates. But it made a big change to not have a former volunteer, except that we had A.Z. Gardner and a lot of other. It didn't change that much, really, because we've had people out of the State Department before as IBS directors. And philosophically and in every way, you know, I had to tell other friends that were applying, like Clooney, that it was hard and yet it was easy because, in a way, I wouldn't want to see a real close friend dealing with what I knew the difficulties were. But I didn't know how bad. But Tony said later that IBS was bankrupt. It was totally bankrupt. I don't know if they felt Dick didn't understand, but when they made that rule that 50% had to be private funded and 50% government, and that may have been too hard. I think Dick would agree with that. That was too hard to make that much of a change. But Tony got funding from Ford Foundation and from some other to help to bridge that.
You take somebody who knows how to write up. I mean, getting funding, there's money. You cannot believe how much money is available if you know how to get it.
Yeah, how to tap it. But at that point, our programs and stuff a lot, you know, were unpopular. And we had to look into developing new areas, which we did then develop more in Bangladesh and in other areas. And because when you look at the numbers, it was just all Southeast Asia. And that was ending. And we knew that. And then Don Lewis was put on the board after he left. I mean, he had been out. And I felt that I was pleased that politically, even though there were a lot of government, like Paul Warnke was on the board, there were a lot of government-type people that really were questioning and the whole stuff in Southeast Asia, but valuing IBS's role and saying this is still important. Katzenbach used to say something that I think will show up in your reports, that maybe our biggest contribution was to the volunteers themselves.
Oh.
You know,
no
and
question.
What they would bring home with them, not what we did.
Absolutely.
And I knew this for me, and I think one reason I was motivated was because here I'd been in three countries. I never got to complete one thing I started. You know, I go to, you know, we're going to move to Siem Reap and teach there, okay? Then we teach in Balak or... And we just get started to knowing the people. Then we moved away, and then I'm evacuated. Then we moved to Takek and start to open the Nome Boat Project, and then I'm pregnant, so we can't finish that. So I ended up 2 years of IBS feeling like, gee,
yeah, I didn't know a damn thing.
But I did know a lot of people, and I knew from being part of IBS what IBS was accomplishing,
yeah.
And then going to USAID and seeing what other people and how much money's been here versus how much money has been over here. And I went to a lot of the meetings in Vientiane about IBS because I really saw IBS as one of the most valuable things that the government or anybody could be supporting. And the best bargain, you know, the qualified people for the money.
The problem a politician has when he's voting on money for something is he can't see what IBS is doing because it's not building dams and bridges and roads. It's more on a personal level. And aid has to count bodies, just like the military did. It has to, what did we get for our money?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And the other thing that hasn't been able to be measured is what's being brought home in terms of human resources.
Well, that's
here.
That's what I think this is
and,
about.
Yeah, and then the other part of it is that was a joke to us is that we had to buy American once we were, well, even IBS, we were supposed to buy everything from, so we'd buy from the Sears catalog and it would be made in Japan or made in Hong Kong, and yet it would have saved a lot more money. Have we been able to buy things locally?
We
have to
save
so them. Because Congress was insisting on this for the benefit of the companies at home, they really should have looked at the investment in sending people overseas.
Okay, a couple of questions.
I've got to get going.
Oh, okay.
So, are next week? No, I can't do it next week. I won't be back.
Well, we'll do it again. I'll be back.
Okay. June, thank you very much.
But we'll get together again,
yeah,
with Jerry. Tell Jerry hi.
Tell Marvin to come over, and
yeah,
I'll show
him
how to use this thing.
Now
and are you going to be in town for how much longer?
Another week.
Can you get over to the shop?
Probably not.
Okay.
We're going to be doing too much at the house.
Okay.
We'll set a timer here with Jerry.
Okay, good. I have a delivery coming at 10 o'clock.
Okay.
And I think it might
And I just need to ask a couple of questions. But is there the men's room that way?
Because
that says ladies
right.
And that says ladies.
I think.
Be right back.
What I wanted to ask was, what year did you join the board?
72. I'd have to look it up.
My impression was that Richard tried to do away with...